prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we review underseen horror movies, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
And I'm Lance.
So before we get into the movie, we actually got a message from a listener about last episode. So my friend Brian Clark, he's a writer for Scream Magazine, commented regarding Ishiro Honda being an uncredited director for Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine. You remember that,
yeah.
Lance? Okay.
Yeah, I did. I saw that comment too.
Okay. So for listeners, if you were curious about that, Brian said, quote, regarding Ishiro Honda's direct credit on Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine, which is awesome and has a killer theme song. The climax of the movie takes place on a missile testing range, and bits of the frontier missile sequence from the American cut of Mothra vs. Godzilla, distributed by AIP, were used as stock footage. I'm sure whoever edited that IMDb entry thought they were being terribly clever, but since it's special effects footage and not a dramatic scene, it would have been directed by, and I'm going to butcher this, I'm sorry, Eiji Tsubuhara. I don't think I got that right at all. Not Honda. So I'm sorry for butchering that name, but I do thank you, Brian, for that clarification point.
Yeah, that was very good. I was a little hesitant on even, I think I even like mentioned that on that episode where I'm like, I don't know if this is real, but.
Yeah, no, you gave a disclaimer about it, but it's like, why is it even there on IMDb? Mystery solved, thanks to Brian.
Yeah, that's good to know. Thanks, Brian. That's awesome.
Okay, so on this episode, we are continuing our April Showers of Blood theme with Blood Delirium from 1988.
Emptiness. Overflowing emptiness. The presence of the infinite. Eyes without dimension. Wings of invisible light. The restless eye of the spirit dispels the mists of the arcane, glimpsing future fragments. Always present. Never seen.
Who are you? Let me see you!
Don't be frightened. Strange things will happen which you will find inexplicable. But in the infinite, in the future, everything is clear.
These bold colors represent nature and transformation. Nothing more, nothing less.
He believes in reincarnation.
I understand. He thinks he was going to go with a previous.
I can't believe you don't see it. It's so obvious.
Maestro, what's the matter?
I want to express the ferment of life in evolution. But I don't know the first thing about evolution or life.
Is there anything I can do?
Can you give me the color of suffering? There you are, miserable pervert. You lunatic! How much longer am I going to have to put up with this insanity?
Now, unfortunately, there's only a cut version available on YouTube. It's about 10 minutes shorter than the original version, and all the boobies and gore are cut out. But you can watch it there if you want. But if you do have your own legal adjacent means of watching it, knock yourself out. As of this recording, it has 102 views on Letterboxd, so this is definitely a criminally underseen Italian late 80s horror movie.
Yeah.
Okay, full disclosure, I had a very hard time putting this summary together, folks. It is not an easy movie to follow. It's the full-on Italian horror, this doesn't need to make sense type of movie, so bear with me as I go through the plot here, which will have spoilers in it, but we'll get into why you should still watch it after that. So, okay, Blood Delirium. Sybil, a concert pianist, is in her apartment, topless, preparing a romantic dinner for her boyfriend, Gerard. She gets a message from Christine, which I initially thought was on her answering machine, but I guess not. Anyway, Christine says she's a spirit who is still alive or from the other side, who she says is talking to her either from the future or another dimension or the beyond. I'm not sure, but that she wants to protect her. The wind kicks up, piano music starts. "Who are you?" asks Sybil. "I'm you. We are two flames as one," says Christine's voice. Gerard then comes home and Sybil pleads with him to believe what she has just experienced. At the castle of Charles St. Simon, an artist, his wife Christine dies in her bed. Speaking of two flames as one and delirium, the name of Charles's favorite piano piece of music, intercut with Sybil playing that same piece on her piano at home. At the funeral, Charles's butler Herman molests Christine's corpse, kissing and fondling her, professing his love. Charles catches him and attacks him, but for some reason still keeps him in his employ. Charles tries painting after his wife's death, but feels his inspiration gone along with his wife. He looks to the cemetery in the distance and vows to bring her home. Herman helps Charles retrieve his wife's corpse, and they bring it back to the house, propping it up at the piano beside his easel. "She looks better now, don't you think?" says Charles, despite her body rotting with maggots. Charles begins painting furiously, but then hallucinates Christine laughing at him, so Herman takes the corpse away. Sybil goes to Charles's art exhibit. She sees a painting that looks like her and tells Charles that she is a pianist. He tells her about Christine and invites her to his castle to see more of his art. We overhear others at the exhibit talking about how Charles thinks he is the reincarnation of Van Gogh. On his drive home, Charles is visited by three ghosts. Not really, they're three glowing orbs, which we can assume are meant to represent Christine. He encounters Sybil on the road, who says she was on her way to his castle to take him up on his offer when her car broke down. Once at the castle, Sybil is first inconveniently unable to leave, but it soon becomes a situation of her being forced to stay and fill the role of Christine for Charles. Herman continues to be a creep by sexually assaulting a young girl at a mechanic shop while Sybil just watches. Sybil then discovers a walk-in refrigerator with an electric latch to keep the dog away from it. She later plays Delirium on the piano for Charles to help inspire him while he paints, but he moans that he still doesn't feel anything. He needs the color of life, the color of suffering. Herman has gone back to kidnap the girl at the mechanic's shop and kills her in the barn when she resists his advances. Charles comes in as this happens and sees the blood and immediately realizes that he has discovered the color of suffering that he needs for his paintings. They hang her body upside down in Charles's studio to let her blood. Once he has enough, Herman takes the body away, Charles warning him not to molest her body. Sybil is woken by the noise of Herman in the barn dismembering the body of the young girl, and on the way to investigate, discovers Christine's body in the refrigerator, which apparently the cat has been snacking on. Sybil tries to leave, but her car has not yet been fixed, so she is taken back to the house. Herman holds her down and injects a sedative, then proceeds to rape her while she hallucinates about geckos. Sybil tries again to escape by calling her friend Corinne to come save her. Herman catches her in the act, and he and Charles get Corinne's address from Sybil's address book to intercept her and to bring her back to the castle under false pretenses. As soon as Corinne arrives with Herman at the castle, she is killed by dogs and then drained of her blood like the previous girl because Charles was low on paint. Sybil's boyfriend Gerard follows the courier truck that is going to Charles's castle in order to find Sybil. Once he gets nearby, he somehow gets a helicopter and flies it over the castle. Herman, alarmed by the helicopter, works quickly to preserve his fondling corpses. But then Gerard flies away. Sybil has now been sedated again, put into Christine's nightgown and into the glass case in the refrigerator. Then we get some more Herman fondling. Gerard, having ditched his helicopter, then hitches a ride with the same courier truck back to the castle and poses as one of the delivery guys to try to find and rescue Sybil. Gerard gets electrocuted when he tries to open the refrigerator. Both he and Sybil get tied up in the art studio to be drained as Charles prepares to paint his masterpiece, Blood Wedding. As Charles begins finger painting, Christine's spirit arrives. The wind kicks up, all the eyes in his paintings cry blood, and the three glowing orbs set his paintings on fire, cut Charles's ear off, and release Sybil and Gerard from their chains. As Sybil and Gerard run down the stairs to escape, Christine's corpse in the glass case rolls down the stairs behind them, and her spirit speaks to Sybil, saying again that they are two flames as one. Gerard and Sybil escape into the helicopter, while Charles and Herman die hand in hand in the art studio. And I think probably one of the last lines in this movie spoken by Christine sum it up pretty well. Quote, "It may be difficult to understand, but you must trust me."
Okay, I have to applaud your synopsis, because people that are listening, if none of that made sense to you, that's because Erica explained it exactly as it unfolds on screen. This movie is so weird that you don't know what's real. It's a blast.
Yeah, it is. It is the epitome of Italian horror logic thrown out the window. We'll get into that. I'm going to get into the crew a little bit here first. So this film was written and directed by Sergio Berganzelli. He has also directed In the Folds of the Flesh, which is a World War II trauma giallo. And it's another one that confounds logic. I'm not even going to try to. I'm spent on trying to explain a plot of a Berganzelli movie, so I'm not going to try. But I will just say that I watched it last year, and I think I gave it 4 stars. I'd highly recommend it. So if you can find In the Folds of the Flesh, definitely check it out. Another one. He also did a nunsploitation film called Our Lady of Lust, which was standard fare. It's pretty good. And then he also did a handful of spaghetti westerns, including The Last Gun, starring Cameron Mitchell, and Raise Your Hands, Dead Man, You're Under Arrest, 1971. Lance, have you seen any of those? Either of those?
I've seen The Last Gun. I watched that one. And it's, you know, kind of tame. I mean, there's a lot of horny Herman-type characters, actually. This one's from 64, so it's not nearly as crazy as Blood Delirium. But there's a lot of horny cowboys involved. But Cameron Mitchell basically plays this, like, Clark Kent Superman in the Wild West, because he's basically a gunfighter who throws down his six-shooter to retire, and he goes by the name of Bill in town. But when bad guys are in town, he wears a handkerchief and goes by Jim Hart, and he saves the day. So it's interesting. I mean, I'd recommend it if you're into spaghetti westerns, for sure.
Genesploitation, check. cinematography is by Rafael Mertes. He also did Argento's Trauma and Michele Suave's The Sect from 1991, a.k.a. Demons. Was that the... Oh, I'm already forgetting my DCU. I feel like it's like 4 or 5. It's one of those in there.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure either. I do want to, you know, let everyone know, because I know everyone was, you know, waiting with bated breath to find out when this was going to happen. I finally finished the DCU because I watched The Sect this week. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, it's okay. I'd rank it somewhere in the middle in the DCU. All right. And the score is by Nello Ciangarotti. He has 4 credits only, including this film. And all of his film credits are other Berganzelli films. La Cognatina, 1975. Dirty World, 1978. And La Monda Nuda, 1980. And so the cast, we have, it's a fairly small cast. We really only have about 3 or 4 central characters and then a couple of peripheral ones. So I'll just go through those really quick. John Philip Law plays the artist Charles St. Simon. He's also been in Barbarella, Space Mutiny, Danger Diabolic, Night Train to Terror, Death Rides a Horse, and The Cassandra Crossing. Lance, you did Night Train to Terror for Junesploitation last year, right?
I think so.
Okay.
I mean, I know I've seen it. Yeah, that one's kind of just as confusing as this movie, but even more so.
Got it. John Philip Law knows what he likes.
Yeah, he has a type.
Then we have Gordon Mitchell, who plays Herman, Charles's butler and accomplished slash necrophile. He was in Spartacus, Rio Bravo, Fellini's Satyricon, The French Sex Murders, which Vinegar Syndrome put out last year, Sartana the Gravedigger, and Shanghai Joe. Bridget Christensen plays both Sybil and Christine. She was in a couple of Lucio Fulci Presents TV movies like Hansel and Gretel and Bloody Psycho, and really not much else. This is definitely the highlight of her career, even though I haven't seen the others, but I can say that confidently, I think.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say.
Yeah. Then Marco Di Stefano plays Gerard, Sybil's boyfriend. He was in a few later Fulci films like Cat in the Brain and Touch of Death and Enigma. He was also in one of the Lucio Fulci Presents movies, Bloody Psycho, along with Bridget Christensen. Then we have Olinka Hardiman as Corrine, Sybil's friend, and Lucia Prato, Yvonne, who is the gas station mechanic slash woman victim in this movie. So that's pretty much it. I mean, it's a pretty, you know, small cast and not too much to get into this as far as the crew goes and production. There really isn't that much out there. So we'll get into our thoughts about this film right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal: providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Okay, my first thought when I first watched this movie was that it feels like they had a script, but they also were kind of just making it up as they went along. I don't know. What was your first impression, Lance?
I mean, honestly, the first impression, as soon as it kicked off, you know, it starts off with, I guess it's Sybil, you know, and she starts taking her, or no, is that what it starts off with?
Oh, Sybil, yeah. Well, it the very opening, the very first scene is Charles speaking to himself about his pain and suffering. Like, he's already, like, first scene, established myself as the suffering artist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's saying really deep stuff. That's just, he's just so emotionally destroyed.
Yeah.
Like, he's overflowing emptiness, eyes without dimension. Yeah, that's right. and then it goes to Sybil. Yeah, and then it starts cutting, you know, to Sybil with his weird voice happening. And then it cuts to Charles, who also goes by Maestro. I'll probably start calling him Maestro.
Okay, that makes it easier.
Yeah, Maestro and his dying wife, Christine. And then it, like, keeps jumping back. To me, it felt like an AGFA horror trailer show. Like, I didn't know what was happening. It was a collection of weird vignettes that were just, like, all featured someone frightened or confused or sad and angry. It was like a collection of trailers from different movies.
Yeah, I can totally see that. Like, it doesn't feel like, are we in the same movie? Because it jumps all over the place and you have no sense of direction for the first, you know, 5-10 minutes.
Right. Yeah. And even when his wife dies, it seems like the next night he goes to dig up his wife's dead body with Herman, but it's actually a year later. And you don't really feel that until somebody says it, like, you've been gone for a year. The whole timeline and the actions of just everything about this movie is just confusing, but fun.
Yeah. And I didn't even realize that it was a year later that he went to go dig up her corpse until the second watch, because I missed that one passing comment. And I was like, wow, her body is rotten, like, really quickly.
That's exactly why I was like, no way. Like, in my notes, I was like, okay, she really fucking decomposed, like, you know, in just a few hours. But then, yeah, it was later that comment was made. And I was like, okay, there we go.
Yeah.
That makes more sense, but there was no indication of that otherwise.
But even if they hadn't had that comment in there, that would just fit with the movie, where you're just like, what?
Yeah, it would have actually elevated the movie to just just that tiny little next step of weirdness. I mean, it doesn't need any more, but yeah, it would have been fine without that.
Yeah.
I mean, shit, they could have dug her body up in the past, like taken a time machine and dug her up, and it still would have worked.
Yeah. What I love about this is that it has that comfort of an Italian horror movie where the plot is secondary to the mood and weirdness of it. Like, you catch yourself asking, like, why, how, what? But then you like just need to stop yourself and remind yourself, like, I'm watching an Italian horror movie, like, logic out the window.
Yeah, this is a perfect example of that. We have to talk about Maestro. You know, the tormented, just tortured artist. I loved every scene he was in, just to hear him either talk about his paintings or just speak about life or his mood or anything in general, because he is so emotionally destroyed and so heartbroken. He's just so poetically angry. Yeah. And, you know, like in the very beginning, it kicks right into him just dramatically whispering these deep thoughts, you know, as he looks out over the sunset. I had to write down some of his some of his best lines, which are pretty much every line in the script from him. But there was a scene where you kind of mentioned it in the summary, where Sibyl says, "Is there anything I can do to help while he's painting?" And he shouts at her, "Can you give me the color of suffering?" And I'm like, "Oh my god, that is like all these lines could be used in songs and stuff." A few more that I just had to write down. Our useless pride drowned in a sea of eternal chaos. Now, this is just him usually talking by himself. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he's talking to Sibyl. My ideas no longer penetrate the canvas. I'm living in a fog. And when he's burning paintings, scatter the ashes to the winds. Burn everything. But Maestro, this guy just goes for it. When he bawls, when he cries, he's grunting and laughing and crying. And he's like an upset high school emo kid stuck in a Kenny Loggins, like a Kenny Loggins looking guy. Actually, he reminded me of the bearded dad from My Two Dads. If you remember that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, shit.
Yeah, that's who, like, when I saw him, I was like, who does he remind me of? You know, he's like this kind of tan, good looking, feathered hair, you know, beard.
Well, he's still clearly going for like the Van Gogh look, like with like, he's kind of got the red hair. So he's got like the full beard. So he is trying to mimic his idol. And, you know, on the subject of the sort of over the top performances, I guess I watched this for the podcast sort of, because I was like, oh, there's that Kirk Douglas movie where he plays Vincent Van Gogh. And I was like, I should watch that. And talk about like going for it. Kirk Douglas was clearly going for an Oscar, because every scene was a fucking monologue from him. There was just like, but you got to get out into nature, because like, that's where life is happening. Like, everything was just like, oh my God, tone it down. Like, I can't take it. It's too much.
Yeah. There's that scene in Blood Delirium where I guess he's showing off in a gallery. It's when Sibyl first shows up and they meet, but people are asking him about his paintings. Like, oh, what a tormented artist. Like, what does this mean? And he's like, the bold colors represent nature and transformation. Nothing more, nothing less. It's so obvious. But I don't know. Every word he said, I was just like, this is, you know, whoever wrote the dialogue to this really nailed down this tortured artist who, nobody understands me. Nobody will, you know, I can't, all I have is my art. And if I don't have this, I have nothing. You know, it's just, he did a great job.
Yeah. And I wonder, because, you know, so the version that we watched was dubbed in English with Russian subtitles, for whatever reason. And so at first I was like, well, I wonder if like what he actually said, you know, in the original, because it's still dubbed over. It's not necessarily his voice, even though he's not speaking Italian, but I'm wondering if it was delivered any differently. But then his, like, how he emotes, you're like, no, he's going for it even in that. So it's just, it's so much though.
Those, I don't know if they dubbed the grunts and then him howling while he cries and the yells, like, I think it is all dubbed, but he's definitely performing what you're listening to.
Yeah. He's like, we talked, I think it was last episode, how we love the creeps in movies, and he's definitely got that vibe. Like, he's not as bad as Herman, who's my favorite for obvious reasons.
I mean, as soon as you said we were talking about the creeps, I know we were segueing into Herman, because he is he's almost too much. He almost takes it to another level.
What's funny, like, because he does almost take it to another level is because, you know, you can describe, it's like, oh yeah, he's he attacks this girl and he molests her and he like tears her shirt off and starts licking her boob, and like she's obviously trying to force him off of her. Right. And he's fondling dead bodies, and he rapes Sybil after he drugs her. Like, I mean, yeah, obviously he's a shitbag, but he takes it to this other level where for me, it didn't feel sleazy, because it was almost more humorous because the whole movie is so off the rails.
Right. And he's an older guy. He seems like a, you know, like someone's dad, you know, he has a look that's not, doesn't give him a craziness. Like, the actor is just like, oh, okay, I guess this is like his servant. But when he's immediately introduced, he just starts. It's when they get the body of Christine, or no, Christine's dead. It's before, I think, she's buried, and he starts just groping and kissing and like dry humping her dead body. And that's when Maestro's like, "You idiot, get off her!"
Yeah,
and I mean, right away, you know that this guy, okay, they're gonna go for some sick fucking shit in this, and he doesn't, like you said, we've mentioned that we love the assholes in this film, but. I do respect how vulgar he is. Gordon Mitchell just did a great job to play this unhinged, creepy molester, like in this kind of stoic face.
Yeah. But
that scene of him attacking Yvonne, you know, when at the station or wherever, where she's like dancing around, like, la la la, hands off the merchandise.
Yeah.
I wish she would have just cut him open, like right there when she had the gun or the knife. I was just like, do it. But she was an odd one, you know.
Yeah.
Fucking Sybil just stood there watching.
Yeah.
So she's a horrible person. Sybil's a terrible person, because there's that scene. And then later that night, Herman takes Yvonne to the castle and murders him. And, you know, it's clear that Maestro and Sybil can hear her yelling. And he's like, go in the room, close the door, lock the door, whatever you hear. So she's just sitting there getting dressed, ready for bed as they're like, killing and raping this girl outside and not doing anything. So fuck Sybil. And yeah, that's all I got to say.
No, I am 100%. Yeah. Like, she gets a painting that Maestro somehow has a painting of her friend Corinne. And he was like, oh, it's just in my mind or something like that. I don't know. So yeah, he gives her that painting of Corinne, and yeah, she goes and gets dressed to go to bed, and is like just hanging a painting casually while a woman is like fucking screaming for her life outside. And I'm like, yeah, way to go, Sybil.
Yeah. Gerard's kind of, her boyfriend is kind of a terrible person too, because, you know, I'm skipping around here, but when he breaks into the castle, you know, to, you know, essentially save Sybil, he's like breaks into, I guess they called it Herman's museum, like his little workshop. Mm-hmm. Where all the dead bodies are and stuff. And then a cat pops up and he grabs the cat all pissed off. He's like, get out of here. And he throws it. And I'm like, okay, you're a fucking asshole, Gerard. It's just a cat. He's not.
The cat's not doing anything. The cat's just like, you know, he's just chewing on some skin. All right. Let the cat eat.
Yeah. Just chewing on Christine's face. What's left of it. So yeah, Sybil and Gerard, they definitely deserved to be together, as Christine says at the end, because they're two peas in a fucking asshole pod.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing about it too, is like it fits in, again, it's one of those things that fits into a movie that defies logic, because it's like, I like the bad guys so much. I mean, I usually do, but like a normal person watching this, no normal people aren't going to watch this movie. Anyway, I know. But like, you know, I'm rooting for the necrophile and the guy who is draining people of blood for his paint, versus like the woman who is being kidnapped against her will because she sucks, and her dumb ponytail boyfriend who, where did he, okay, helicopter. What?
So, okay. So when he said ponytail made me laugh too, because as soon as I saw him, I was like, okay, look at this guy. He looks like Armand from Interview with the Vampire. Like he has his hair back in a ponytail. He's wearing some weird fancy like pullover shirt that just made him look like, you know, Antonio Banderas, or he was dressed like a matador or something. Yeah. But yeah, the helicopter thing, that threw me for a loop, because there is a scene when they're driving. This is before they pull. This is right before they're driving in his convertible and they pull up before Maestro's gallery show. And that's when she jumps out and he's got to go to work. Or he's talking to her and he says, how about a grand piano for a wedding gift or something, or a birthday gift or something? And she's all, oh, okay, well, how about your own personal helicopter? Just setting up like, okay, this guy's going to be the pilot of a helicopter later.
Okay.
Does that make no sense to me? I didn't catch it. I kind of sped watched it the second time.
Mm-hmm.
But in my first notes, I was like, okay, this guy's fucking flying a helicopter now, my first watch. And then I caught that and I was like, oh my God, that's like the most poorest attempt at setting up. He's a pilot, because I would have guessed he was a vampire or a matador.
Yeah. I missed that line altogether. And I was still like, okay, well, clearly he's got experience flying, but was this established at any point? So if you miss a throwaway line, then an entire scene is going to be like, what the fuck to you? But again, who cares? Because it's fun, because randomly Gerard just, well, because it also doesn't make sense, because where did you just, okay, I'm in a helicopter now, instead of just going in the truck with the couriers. But he's like, no, it'll take too long. I got to fly there. So he flies the helicopter to the castle, flies it around the castle a little bit to like survey the scene or whatever, but it doesn't have a shot of him seeing Sybil's car or her or any indication that she's actually there. But he somehow decided that she is. So then he goes and lands the helicopter out in a field, I guess, sort of nearby, and then gets back into the courier truck and goes with them. And then, like, because the courier truck is bringing all of Maestro's artwork back from the gallery to his castle. So, yeah, I was like, what? You're in the exact same place that you were. It's like,
he doesn't play it cool at all either. It's like, as soon as he's in, he's like, so is Sybil here? You know, like, boom, like just starts asking Herman and he's like, get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
You know, it just, he's not a very, very cool guy. Like he doesn't, obviously he goes in to save the day, but he gets pretty much his blood drained in order for it to happen. Actually, Christine's the one who saves them all. And another part that makes no sense to me is the whole Christine and Sybil relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we've already kind of pointed on that the timeline seems all fucked up, like, to me.
Right.
But in the very beginning, Christine is introduced as this, you know, this being that's talking to Sybil, saying that she says that she'll soon leave her body. So I'm assuming she's not dead yet, because we cut to that scene.
Right.
This is all a year before all this stuff, later stuff happens. And then on her deathbed, she kind of seems to be in love with the maestro, although she can't really get the words out.
Mm-hmm.
But she's kind of warning Sybil of Maestro. So she should have just warned her right away. But I guess she uses Sybil to get her revenge on Maestro. I mean, it's just
got me.
And then at the end, she's like, you know, that's when they're outside the castle, Maestro's dead, and they're like, she's like, it's all over now. No one will hurt you again. And I wanted to be like, bitch, you put her like in this situation. This is your fault. Like,
yeah, because like in the beginning, when Christine first talks to Sybil, she's like, I'm talking to you from the future, from another dimension. I have not yet left my body. I'm like, wait, that's a lot of information to unpack right there. It's you're from another from the future in another dimension, but you're still in your own body. But what? Yeah. But then she's like three orbs show up there, and then they show up again at the end when she's talking to Sybil again, and the whole, you know, we are two flames as one. And what?
The orbs show up too when, her car breaks down, and mm-hmm. when Maestro pulls up and the orbs are there, and I guess she's laughing at him while he's driving.
Yeah.
So it's almost, I don't know, maybe they were kind of indicating some sort of possession, or I really don't know, or that I guess she's just always with her. I mean, they're two flames and one, so
they're the same.
I'm not going to try and make sense of that. I can't.
Yeah, there's multiple timelines, then it's the same woman, but
they were both alive together at one point, right? But so when one died, they turned into one flame. I don't know. The whole thing is weird, and it's all so damn emotional. It's like with Maestro crying and grunting and slobbering like every other scene. It's almost too much. Like, it's like a bad trippy soap opera.
Yeah,
and I know. And I bring Twin Peaks a lot, but I did have tinges of Twin Peaks.
Okay.
One specific line was when it like really punched me in the face. It's when Herman is explaining to Sybil, how are you saying?
I don't know.
That, you know, there's this electric lock on the door to keep the dogs out from eating their cheese and meats.
Right.
And then there's this silent pause. And then he says, and it's very just him, you know, no surround, no sound, background noise. And he says, if the window's left open, the crows fly in. And it's just a strange pause immediately after that. And I'm like, okay, that's the world of Twin Peaks. So, I loved it. You know, it's just overacting galore and good stuff to watch.
Yeah. I think one of like my favorite things too, besides all of this, but like even like the paintings themselves, you see some of his actual artwork, and he's clearly trying to mimic Van Gogh, but there was one in particular that I loved. And I think it was one of the first ones she saw and asked him about. He's like, oh, that's Satan fathering the universe. Yes. It's this fucking demon down on all fours, like assed facing us. And it's like this white diarrhea coming out of his head.
And she's like, oh, and this walks over and just like casually starts playing piano or something. And I'm just, okay, that's an artist talking.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I would totally have that painting in my house. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, I always wonder that too. Like even with my double feature pick, and maybe yours too, but when there's original paintings mm-hmm. in movies, like The Church, you know, like mm-hmm. those type of movies, are those like, do crew members have those? Do some of the directors and actors have those? Like, are they out there?
Yeah, I would love
like a painting from a bird with the crystal plumage. Mm-hmm. That one would be great to have.
Oh, the deep red ones too. Yeah. Like,
yeah,
man. See, there's so much. Oh. I think I would. Top of the list now, though, is Satan fathering the universe, because I just need to have Satan's ass in my face spewing fucking diarrhea to create the world.
Yes, that's a good one. That's a good pick.
Yeah,
I'd have to think about that. What I'd pick.
So I mentioned the composer in the crew, and he doesn't have very many credits. But Lance, what are your thoughts about the score in this?
It was weird. I mean, there's a lot of classical music in here because, you know, Christine and Sybil both are classical pianists. So he does this Nello, I think it was his name, like a classical with 80s beats and stuff. There's definitely the Italian, you know, kind of poppy synth going on too. But I'm guessing he composed the music that was Christine's, that was Delirium, that was, you know, that Maestro listens to on his boombox while painting. I guess that's an original score, which is kind of, it's really catchy.
Yeah.
And it's good. I think it works perfectly for this movie because pretty much the music throughout, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense as like a cohesive body of music. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, a perfect fit. I liked it because it did have like that Italian horror, fast-paced, you know, stuff going on here and there. But the classical elements was kind of cool because he would kind of like layer it with 80s beats and stuff.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. I definitely, the Delirium piano song is very, very catchy. And they use it a lot in this movie. Like pretty much anytime a door opens, cue music.
It's like start a scene with it then end the scene with some dialogue, and the next scene starts with it. It's like, okay, it's worthy. And I mean, and the ending too, it never ends. I don't know if you got the feeling the first time you watched it, like, okay, here's the ending. Oh, no, wait. So like Christine's talking to Sybil about it being all over. I'll always be with you.
Yeah.
And a shining bright light is on Sybil's face. And you're like, okay, that's a cool ending. You assume that Herman and Maestro are dead. But no, there's this weird dialogue, a long dialogue between Sybil and Gerard about staying together and believing each other and being madly in love with each other.
Yeah.
And then they leave. And I'm like, okay, that's the end. No, then we cut to Maestro, who's bawling and, you know, crazy, and the house starts collapsing on him and Herman. Then they finally die. So that's the end. But no, we have to see Gerard and Sybil run to a helicopter and take off.
Yes.
And let's get about 2 minutes of aerial shots of the castle. and then we'll just fly off into the sunset. Now the credits roll and it's like, boom, you thought you were confused before. You know, sit on that for a bit.
Oh, I love this movie. Okay, so let's get to our recommendations then. Lance, what'd you give it on Letterboxd? What would your double feature pick be with it?
I gave it 3.5 stars with a heart. I mean, I say this every episode at least. When I talk about it, I'm like, it deserves so much more. But I highly recommend this to everybody, fans of horror, fans of Twin Peaks, fans of anything. I mean, just the weird. If you like, you know, blockbusters or anything like that, and you're strictly your thing, you're not going to get through I'm sure a lot of people don't get through like the first 5 minutes of this.
Yeah.
But my double feature pick, I'm going with a film by Herschel Gordon Lewis, which has blood in the title. So I'm going to keep with the April Showers of Blood theme.
Yeah.
And it's called Color Me Blood Red from 1965. And this one's about a tortured artist who's obsessed at finding the perfect color for his canvas. And one night, by chance, his girlfriend cuts herself on a nail and drips blood on one of his canvases. And then when he sees the color in the morning, he like freaks out and ends up murdering her and others to continue his paintings. It's the third film from Lewis's Blood trilogy. And it's all very hip to the scene, daddy-o, you know, beatnik feeling with killer jazz. But with the obvious like similarity of using blood in paintings between these two movies, and the tortured artist, it's in Color Me Blood Red. He's very similar to Maestro. Like they each share some great freak out moment scenes, but it's streaming on Tubi. It's also on the Arrow Video channel, and Arrow have a Blu-ray out there, but Color Me Blood Red, it's super short. I want to say it was like 75 minutes or something. Yeah. I think this would pair well with, I'd play Color Me Blood Red first and then end it with Blood Delirium, because Blood Delirium is, it's like a bad dream. It's like one of those dreams that you can kind of control what's happening, but then it starts getting out of hand and you get scared and you wake up feeling worried, and it kind of ruins your day because that's all you're thinking about. And you're trying to remember if what you dreamed was real. I mean, that's my double feature pick.
Nice. That's a great pick.
How about you?
So on my first watch, I gave it 3 out of 5 on Letterboxd, with a heart. Rewatch, I haven't gone in and rescored it yet, but I'm going to rescore it a 3.5, because as a lot of times happens, you know, after, you know, a quick rewatch and talking about it, I'm like, actually, I like it that much more now that I'm thinking about it. This is a 3.5. So I'm going to be presently bumping that up. Yeah. It's just got that hazy weirdness, the gore, the sleaze, the necrophilia I love, and this is an Erica movie through and through, so I definitely would recommend it to, you know, Italian horror fans. It's one of those late 80s where there's few and far between that are really worth a watch, so if you have the means to watch it, I would definitely seek it out. And then for my double feature, I had a really hard time narrowing it down, because I was like, there's so many directions you could go with a movie like this. Like initially I was like, ah, fuck it. Necrophilia double feature. Let's do D'Amato's Beyond the Darkness. Nice. But then I was like, well, maybe no, let's just make it a little more general. And, you know, I mentioned late 80s Italian horror is not that great. There's a few out there that are good, like Stage Fright, The Church, Opera,
You gotta put Black Cat in there.
Black Cat, of course. I would never leave that out. I'll fucking vouch for Zombie 3. So, I mean, yeah. But then I was like, okay. And then I was like, no, maybe I'll get more specific and like, you know, do like another art kind of related one. And then I was even thinking like House with Laughing Windows might be a good mix. But then I was like, that's like, is that too much mood for a double feature?
I don't know. It's definitely like a change in fucking mood, like between the two. Like, I mean, yeah, I mean, it would work. Yeah. It would work.
Yeah.
It has the whole dreamlike quality.
It does. So I think you could go with any of those and be happy. Ultimately, though, I did circle back and I did end up going for a late 80s Italian horror double feature, but I wanted to pick another sort of more obscure one as well, one that's got a lot of fun elements to it and that could potentially be covered on this show later. So just FYI. So my pick for a double feature is The Spider Labyrinth, 1988. This is directed by Gianfranco Giagni, and it's about a professor who travels to Budapest to find a lost colleague. And he gets, quote unquote, tangled in a web of weirdness of this town conspiracy, specifically a spider-worshipping cult. There's a lot of slowness in this movie, but the last half hour is just bonkers off the wall. But the movie makes up for it. It's got really great kills in it, really neat special effects, including stop motion. If I had to classify it, I would call it like a supernatural giallo, but with Lovecraftian elements.
Are the spiders what's stop motion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, like, are these normal sized spiders? Are they like human sized?
I don't want to give it away.
Okay. I want to watch this.
It's a lot of fun. It's one of those movies that it's good, but it could have been great if it were made 10 years earlier by Fulci. But right. It's still definitely worth a watch. And the guy who did the effects in this movie did Demons and Demons 2. So there's some like little crossover there. So this does not have a release yet, but and it's not streaming anywhere. So don't worry, Lance, I'll send you a copy of it. Yeah. So late 80s Italian horror double feature. I would go Spider Labyrinth first because I feel like the first hour you're just going to be kind of meandering along. And then the last half hour is going to be like, whoa, what the fuck? And then that kicks you right into Blood Delirium. We are already like in a, like a, whoa, what the fuck is going on? So
yeah, mushrooms is optional, but,
yes. Okay. So that's it for Blood Delirium. So Lance, tell us what we're doing next week or next episode rather.
Yeah, so I'm going to continue, you know, our April Showers of Blood theme for this month. So obviously my pick is a film which includes blood in the title, and it is Blood Tracks from 1985.
Fuck, yeah.
Yes, it's about a rock group called Easy Action who head out with their manager, film crew, and a bunch of groupies to an isolated cabin in the snowy mountains to film an epic music video for their new hit, Blood Tracks. There's also an abandoned factory in the mountains where these gnarly hills have eyes type humanoids don't take kind to strangers in their area. So they start picking off the Easy Action entourage, and an avalanche doesn't really help the situation. So these guys are sitting ducks as they try to figure out how to get out of this pickle to escape the wrath of these deformed backwoods killers. So this one is a ton of fun, great 80s music, cool gore, very cheesy acting, and it's also included in the Swedish Sensations Films book that I've mentioned in past episodes, and I'm really excited to announce that we'll have a special guest joining us for Blood Tracks, and that is the author of the Swedish Sensations Films, Daniel Ekeroth. He'll be joining us from the cool climate of Stockholm, Sweden, and he'll be laying down all the facts and myths surrounding director Mats Helge Olsen and his attempt at a slasher. So Blood Tracks is on YouTube and it's available to rent for 99 cents on Amazon. And it has a really short runtime of under 90 minutes. So definitely check it out before the episode because this one is going to be a lot of fun.
I'm super stoked for this.
I've been just like slobbering over his book since I got it late last year. So it's like, to get him on and talk about Blood Tracks, which is included in there, and talk about, you know, his history with Swedish Sensations films. It's going to be a great episode.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Cool. Looking forward to it. All right. If you are not already, please give us a follow on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd under the username Also Watched. You can also follow my other podcast, Customers Also Watched, on Twitter at CAW Podcast, or Facebook or Instagram under Customers Also Watched. And Lance, where can people follow you?
You can follow me at L Scheibe on Letterboxd, Twitter, and Instagram.
Also, be sure to tune in next week. We're going to have a bonus episode dropping with our Blu-ray wish list with guest Jonathan.
Woo!
That was a lot of fun to record, and I think we've got some... I mean, even if, like, you know, we don't get our wish, at least maybe we're giving you guys something to add to your watch list, so...
Yeah.
So be sure to tune in for that. But otherwise, thanks for listening, and we'll see you back next week for a special bonus episode, and then in 2 weeks for Blood Tracks. Night, y'all.
Bye, everyone.